The first case on our calendar is 02-1350, the State of Ohio versus Kelly Faust. Mr. Doughton.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honor, may we reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal at this time? Your Honors, I am David Doughton, and along with Alan Rossman, I am representing Mr. Faust. This morning, we would like to address two issues with the court. Those are the first and second propositions of law, the first proposition of law being the validity of the jury waiver, the second proposition of law being the sufficiency of the indictment, whether it comports with Ohio and federal law. Addressing the first issue first, basically, the appellant's position is that a jury waiver in a capital matter cannot be valid unless the defendant is advised that he is waiving the jury not only for the purposes of the guilt or not guilt determination, but also for sentencing. Clearly, if you give up your right to a jury, you not only are having a three-judge panel decide your guilt in the matter, but also you are waiving the right to have any one of 12 jurors find that death is not appropriate. In this particular instance, the issue of sentencing was never addressed to Mr. Faust. There was a very brief colloquy with the defendant in which the judge asked him if his signature was on the jury waiver, which it was. He asked him if he understood he had a right to a jury trial, which he did. There was no colloquy with the defense attorneys to ask the defense attorneys, did you go over Mr. Faust's rights with him? The defense attorneys were not even addressed in this hearing. And with that very brief, one page in the transcript colloquy, the judge found it to be a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. What I would like to bring to the court's attention this morning is that we're not working from a silent record today. I know there's a number of cases where the courts found that unless there is something in the record to indicate that there was some improper procedure or some indication that the defendant didn't know what he was doing, that they presumed correctness. And in answer to that, I want to bring out two pieces of the record. Both of them are not in the transcript, but they're in the competency evaluations. The first one, Mr. Faust was referred to the independent, the court psychiatric clinic, and evaluated for competency. This is May 22, 2001 competency report. Page 7, in the competency assessment, the psychologist indicates that Mr. Faust said that the jury determines if you are guilty or innocent. He indicated that the judge is neutral and that the judge determines the sentence. So that, you know, ironically, for to be found competent, you must understand the roles of the party and the participants and their purposes. But in this case, Mr. Faust indicated to the court psychiatric clinic that the judge's duty was to sentence. The defense brought in a independent, their own forensic psychologist, Dr. Karpowicz, in a letter to the judge on September 18th of 2001. Similarly, Mr. Karpowicz is talking about both found Mr. Faust to be competent, and we are not challenging his competency in this case. But one of the reasons for the basis of the competency finding was that Mr. Faust indicated to Dr. Karpowicz that Mr. Faust, and this is on the last page of the, page 7, the last page of the report to Judge Friedman, he knew that a judge or jury would decide about his guilt or innocence based on the evidence which is presented, which of course is correct. He understood that the witnesses would testify against him and that he could have witnesses testify for him. If he is found guilty, he knew that the judge would sentence him. So this is an indication where, and this is prior to the waiver. You know, this isn't an affidavit after the fact in which he's saying that, you know, I didn't know what I was doing at the time. This is in the record to both a court psychiatric doctor and to the independent, and both saying the same thing. If he is found guilty, the judge will sentence him. There's nothing in the record that he had any knowledge that it would be the jury that would sentence him, and more importantly, that if any one of those jurors found death to be inappropriate, he couldn't get the death penalty. In the courts.
Well, we could parse those words, couldn't we? Does the jury actually sentence a defendant in a death case?
Well, yes, and the answer to that is.
I thought they made a recommendation.
Not if it's life. If it's life, it's binding. If for all intents and purposes, if they would have found that in this case death inappropriate, the judge is bound to that determination. And again, this gets into the whole Caldwell issue of, you know, the problem with recommendation. But I think in a capital case, it's fair to say that the jury does sentence them because, again, if one of these jurors find that death isn't appropriate, it's binding on the judge. So for all intents and purposes, it's a jury sentencing. So in to be an intelligent waiver, if you're giving up, and the Ohio legislature gave a substantial right here, to give up that right, you have to know what you're giving up. And there's no indication in the record whatsoever that Mr. Faust had any idea that was.
I guess I don't quarrel with your contention that he may not have understood the jury's role in sentencing. But just citing from the record to his psychological interviews, where he says the judge sentences, that's what lawyers who talk about these cases would say.
And that's precisely the point. If you the tradition is, if you ask 10 people in the street, 10 people in the street would say the jury decides.
No, I'm talking about lawyers who handle these cases. They
would
say
correct.
The judge sentences.
That's correct. I mean, I would agree with you that most lawyers would say that, but that's not correct. And the issue here is whether Mr. Faust understood what he was giving up. You know, if Mr. Faust understood that there was a confession in this case, and he waived a jury. The court's aware that there are limited issues compared to a lot of capital cases for that reason. Mr. Faust's best chance for survival in this matter was that he could convince one of 12 jurors that, for whatever mitigating factors were put out there, that death was not appropriate. That was his best chance in this case. The record is silent, with the exception of what we indicated as to anything about his knowledge that it was discussed with him, that the court discussed with him, the waiver itself, the written.
So the extension of that would be, in your view, it is failure to have competent counsel.
Yes.
To ever waive a jury in a death case?
Well, the simple answer is yes. And clearly, I mean, we defense seminars are constantly urging, you know, defense lawyers not to do it. So in fact, in this case, one of the issues of effective assistance is the fact that he wasn't properly.
So it's axiomatic that if you waive a jury, you're ineffective.
Legally, no. I'd like to make that argument, but I would concede that legally, no, because you may have a case where if you thoroughly talked it out with your client, not that I would agree with that, but I'd have to understand it's a strategy, it's a high publicity case. You have a judge who, and I know this courts have seen this issue, who was allegedly not crazy about the death penalty. You know, that they're factual scenarios, that there are legal issues, for instance, that you think maybe the judge would throw out the specification. I can understand those issues. I may not agree with it, but I think that is an acceptable strategy to make. But before one makes that strategy, it must be discussed with the client so the client knows what he or she is giving up. And that's what's missing in this case, that there's there's no colloquy, there's no indication that this was ever discussed with Mr. Faust. The judge was put on notice that this is what the client believed by these reports. In the judge's sentencing opinion, you know, he indicates that both reports were stipulated to by the party, so it's clearly part of the record. And it was referred to in the sentencing opinion. But there was no questioning of Mr. Faust as to his knowledge of this. And again, this is in many capital cases. I'm sure the court's aware there are two types of capital cases. The rare kind is where there is a question as to guilt. The more prominent is this a life-appropriate case? So actually, the jury function in capital cases is almost more important for the second phase than the first phase. Unfortunately, Ohio does not have a procedure yet, and I would ask, hope the legislature would, to allow a guilty plea to a three-judge panel and then have a judge determine sentencing. Actually, in this case, as an example, conceivably the court might find that the waiver was valid for guilt-innocence determination, but not valid for sentencing. Unfortunately, there's no procedure to allow it to go back and just have a jury, because this isn't a remand for, you know, a Penick situation, to have a jury just redo the sentencing in this aspect. In fact, 292906 specifically states that it's only for a reversal of a mitigation phase, and if you had a three-judge panel at the original trial, then you shall be tried by a three-judge panel with the remand. So there's not this option, which would be nice if we had it, so that there are cases where you would want to plead guilty, but you would want the jury to decide sentencing. It's not available. It also might come up if there were mistrial in the penalty phase. You know, what do you do if there's a mistrial in the penalty phase? Because there's no procedure in Ohio law at this point to allow a jury to be selected except for when there's a remand for a sentencing reversal. So we're in a situation that the waiver, unfortunately, is either valid for the entire procedure or not at all. And again, for the reasons that I stated, because the jury is actually more essential in this particular case and many cases like it for the penalty phase, it's absolutely essential that a capital defendant be advised that it is a jury, not the judge, who can decide his fate. And the odds are much better with convincing one of 12 than one of three.
I'm curious. Is the information that you receive at the continuing education seminars for defense counsel, is that based on, is there empirical data? Are there studies that have been done that would indicate that a defendant has a better chance with a jury than with three judges, or is it just the fact that it's a constitutional right that should not be?
I am not aware of empirical studies. I think the reasons that it is discussed is, frankly, appellate reasons. The belief is if you're waiving your right to a jury, you are waiving jury instruction issues, voir dire issues, sentencing issues, because there is this presumption of correctness with the three-judge panel, which, you know, obviously this court has addressed many times. So that basically you're putting a defendant in all or nothing, you know, that you are gambling that the three-judge panel is going to find death not to be appropriate. If you lose that gamble, your odds of prevailing on appeal, even if there's error, is going to be very difficult because of this presumption of correctness, the presumption the court has done the right thing. Unless there is something in the record to indicate that the three-judge panel affirmatively considered something inappropriate, you're not going to win that issue. And so the main basis that defense counsel are urged, and we know this from reading, you know, Sixth Circuit and this court's opinion, not to waive our appellate reasons, I would say, is the big reasons. And plus there's a litany of cases before this where attorneys have waived to a three-judge panel because they thought they had a sign. I give example, Freddie Dickerson, there was a sign from a judge that he wasn't going to do it. Ron Post, the judge indicated that, you know, that I'm Catholic and I'm not gonna go against my tenets. There were no promises made by the courts, but the lawyer went back and told the clients I think the judge is going to be, we have a better chance. And in both cases, of course, the judge weighed and found that death was appropriate in those cases. So I believe that the urging not to waive jurors is based on that type of information. I cannot tell the court that I'm aware of empirical information on that matter.
Thank you.
I believe, and this is kind of segueing into the second issue, the United States Supreme Court in the 2000s, between Apprendi, Ring, and now Blakely, have shown that the requirement that the grand jury and the jury determine all the elements is quite essential. In Blakely, the court has said even in sentencing issues, they've defined an element as any fact which allows the court to deviate from the legislative minimum that must be found. It must be found by a jury. And I think this segues in because this is consistent with the idea that the capital defendant be aware of this fact. This is a very protected capital or constitutional right that it is the jury that has to decide those matters which allow you to get the maximum penalty. This is completely consistent with where the United States Supreme Court is heading, and again, we don't know the results of Blakely, but it's absolutely
Where are they heading? Didn't they take that matter up again?
I'm sorry.
And where is the U.S. Supreme Court
heading? They addressed that issue on October 4th, the oral argument, and that's on the federal guidelines issue. So we're all expecting a decision probably as early as the end of this year. But, you know, from the argument, it's clear that the majority is sticking with it. In Ohio, and this court's going to be faced with all those issues. But the importance of that for the first proposition is, in fact, that, you know, that the grand jury, in Ohio has an independent right to a grand jury. The grand jury and the finding of the facts by the jury is not merely a notice apparatus. It's essential that the defendant be aware that he has this right, and he has the right to have his fate decided by a jury deciding all the elements. You know, that is, and he has to waive it, but he can only waive it, again, if he's aware of it. And segueing into the second issue, the indictment in this case, and in all cases, is not merely a notice paper. If that were the case, the bill of particulars would suffice. And it just isn't. What the indictment is, and I think this is important, the indictment is the only written proof that we have that the grand jury did its job. The indictment is the only written proof that we have that the grand jury, as is required by the Ohio Constitution, that the jury found probable cause in each and every element of the offense. So that it's not enough that you, and I'll refer to as an example, count two, which is the felony murder based on aggravated burglary. It's not enough that you indicate to the jury, okay, we're charging the felony murder in its aggravated burglary. In this case, none of the elements of aggravated burglary are set forth in the indictment. There is not even, as often happens, you'll see indictments which indicate, fleeing immediately after aggravated burglary, comma, RC section 291111. That's not even here. It only states aggravated burglary.
But you would find it deficient if it did refer to the code.
I would, because I don't think that's sufficient proof that the grand jury actually heard evidence and decided the credibility of each element of the offense. I don't think it's enough. But in this case, we don't even have to address it because the statutory code is not listed in the indictment. And aggravated burglary is a good example. Ohio has four different charges of burglary. They are very similar except for one element. There is a fourth degree burglary, a third degree burglary, a second degree burglary, and a first degree burglary. If the elements of probable cause are only sufficient to bring a third or fourth degree burglary, it's not a capital case. It's not a capital case. And so that if we're going to protect the right, again, Ohio law, the independent right to have the grand jury decide each and every element to find a probable cause existed, we have to have some written proof that the jury, in fact, did that, that this wasn't a case where the detective, whomever, came in and said, you know, he was in the house, this is an ag burglary, indict for this. We have to show that the jury, the grand jury, actually knew what the elements were and there was sufficient evidence that they understood it and so found.
Would that constitute a particularized need for you to get grand jury transcript?
I would argue yes.
Has that been done in this case?
It was not done in this case, but I would argue yes.
Has that been waived?
Well, the issue is then, who is the burden on? If the indictment is insufficient on its face, is it the defendant or is it the prosecution that must show that, in fact, I would argue the prosecution would have the burden to show that its indictment was sufficient, that it, they did consider all those factors? Because on the basis, on its face, there's nothing to indicate.
You mean there's a burden on the prosecutor to show that all indictments returned by the grand jury are sufficient on their face?
This case has not yet been decided. That's what I'm asking this court to decide.
You want us to make a rule of law in this case that says the burden to prove the sufficiency of every indictment is with the prosecution?
Adequacy. I would change it to adequacy. And the argument is, I would say yes. I would like it that if it's clear, if the indictment, well, first of all, the rule of law I want is that it has to be included on here, and if it's not on here, period, it's deficient. It's inadequate, period. If there is a question, or the court, there is a question about its adequacy, when it appears on the, when there's nothing on the face indicating that the grand jury did consider all of the elements necessary to bring back either the principal charge or the specification, then it would be the incumbent, I don't think it should be incumbent on the defense to prove the adequacy of the indictment. You know, it's prima facie. Well, I think it's more than prima facie. I think that if the indictment is not adequate, it's not adequate, period.
All right.
However, if going to your question, if there is an issue about whether they did or didn't, I don't know why the burden would be on the defense to show that the state did its job, why the state presented to the grand jury what needed to be presented, and that the grand jury, in fact, considered those elements and gave the credibility to those elements that it needed.
Thank you.
In this particular case, the first count of the indictment charged prior calculation and design. The three-judge panel found Mr. Faust not guilty of prior calculation and design, so that the remaining counts of aggravated murder all have this problem, either in the specification or in the principal charge. So basically, whether Mr. Faust is eligible for the death penalty or not is dependent upon how this court views this issue. And it's not just this case, but many other cases. Again, we have absolutely no proof that the jury distinguished between a fourth degree aggravated burglary and a first degree aggravated burglary. The elements of aggravated burglary are very similar. In both, even with a fourth degree, stealth, entry by stealth, deception, force is an element. The difference in it is obviously the injury to the somebody inside of the house. Clearly in this case, there was death, and clearly that would be sufficient if it were presented to the grand jury, but we can't go to the facts of the case that came out before the three-judge panel and presume that those facts were presented to the grand jury. And, you know, in closing, I would just indicate to the court that it's not a difficult thing in the indictment to list the elements.
Counsel, what would the defendant have done differently, or the defense have done differently, had the wording been more complete, for example, as you are indicating that it was necessary? How did that impact on the course of the trial?
Well, if this is a, let me, if the court would permit, two ways. First, I would like to address hypothetically. There are many instances in, for instance, kidnapping, where there are four or five different theories that the kidnapping could have occurred, and the defense including the witnesses or how you would argue would be predicated on which element it would be. In this case, I cannot hypothesize how it would be different because I understand there was a confession in this case. I understand that Apprendi Ring does allow for harmless error and an overwhelming factual evidence. One of the difficulties in arguing these cases is that the court doesn't have the post-conviction record before it, so that it's one of the anomalies, I guess, of arguing capital cases is that we're arguing to this court to set the law, and then we have to go to federal court to argue the harmlessness of the law, or whether it was or not, which is just the way it's set up. It's the way we have to deal with it. Based on the record that's here before this court right now, and I'm limited to, I would have to answer your question as in, I don't know. You know, I wish I could tell you. I don't know.
Well, what we're getting at is a prejudice to the defense by not specifying, according to the way you would like to have it. You know, presumably, this defendant's confession helped formulate the indictment.
Presumably.
And I would think that based on that evidence being presented to the grand jury and the charges that flowed from the consideration of the grand jury, it's highly speculative to say that there's insufficiency in this indictment.
I would argue that two ways. The first way to argue is plain error in that this court has defined plain error as whether it's obvious, whether it's a legal right, which clearly it is, and whether it affects a substantial right. So whether this court would find plain error or not would be based upon whether your right to a grand jury is a substantial right. So what we are asking this court to find that in a citizen in this state's constitutional right to have a grand jury is a substantial right. It's essentially structural error. If you want me to argue or give you an argument that the prejudice went better, that if the indictment were right, that a different defense would have been put on in which he would have been acquitted, I concede I cannot do that based on what's here. But we do believe that the right to a grand jury is a substantial right, which needs to be protected as essentially structural error on this basis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dowden. Mr. Debker.
Good morning. My name is John Epker. I'm here on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, representing the appellee in this case, the State of Ohio. May it please the court. Appellant in his opening argument did not contest guilt in this case, so I won't belabor the facts of this case very long for this court. They're pretty well set forth in the record. But briefly, this case does involve a horrific set of events where defendants broke into the house, murdered Mr. Coriano with a hammer, a blow to the head, went upstairs and raped his daughter repeatedly, then set fire to the house and stole and tied up the young girl, tied her to a post of the or a leg of the bathtub, set the house on fire, and left after stealing various items, including the deceased victim's car. The evidence in this case is surely overwhelming. We had eyewitness testimony from the victim, from the girl who was raped, who identified Mr. Faust. She knew him. The forensic evidence indicated Mr. Faust was the perpetrator of this crime. And lastly, but most significantly, we had his confession to this crime. So surely his guilt is well established. I'll address the two issues brought up by opposing counsel this morning. First of all, regarding the jury waiver. Their argument seems to be that this court should change the law and create new rights for, create a new set of rules for jury waivers in a capital circumstance. I would submit that there's no need for that. In this case, there was a valid jury waiver that was signed and filed in compliance with this court's opinion in Pless. And in Gels, this court held that a colloquy is not required to ensure a valid jury waiver. But in the case, our record shows there was a colloquy between the trial judge and defendant to ensure that this was a voluntary waiver of his right to jury. And I may add that at that colloquy in the record, there's no indication from Mr. Faust, from defense counsel, from the judge, or even the prosecutor, that this was anything but a voluntary waiver of his right to jury trial. Their citation to the competency report to bolster their argument that he didn't understand, I think that competency report is insufficient to evidence his misunderstanding in any way of the rights he was waiving. As Justice Pfeiffer pointed out, his competency report notes that he said that the judge sentences him, and I think that's a correct statement of law. I think the fact that he says judge sentences him doesn't evidence that he in any way misunderstood his right to trial by jury and the right that he was waiving that day in court, which was signed by opposing counsel and filed in the record. Or signed by his counsel and filed on record. More pointedly, this court's opinion from this summer in Fitzpatrick goes right to the heart of their claim raised by Mr. Faust. And in Fitzpatrick, this court ruled that in order to be a valid jury waiver, there doesn't need to be this extra inquiry of understanding on the part of the defendant. They don't have to understand the unanimity requirements with capital cases, or there needs to be no inquiry into all the appellate issues that go along with that. So based on this court's holding in Fitzpatrick, I think that resolves this issue, and there's no need to revisit that issue. And in fact, in Fitzpatrick, the court noted, disagreed with a district court holding, State versus Soul, and this court disagreed with that holding. Since that opinion, Soul's been overruled by the Sixth Circuit, reversed. So this court's opinion is in full compliance with the Sixth Circuit on that issue. There's just no need to revisit this issue. His jury waiver was valid. It's on the record, and there seems to be no question about its validity in this case. Next, I'll turn to appellant's argument regarding the indictment and the sufficiency of the indictment.
Well, counsel, you said there seems to be no question. It seems that your opponent devoted the largest part of his argument to that question. Is he wrong in saying that in a death case, in most death cases that we see, the fact that the individual in front of the court on trial is the perpetrator is rarely in doubt? It's an unusual circumstance. And there's some doubt about that. Your office probably doesn't even attempt to go for the death case if you have any real degree of doubt about the person being the perpetrator, but rather the legal questions that surround the arrest, the confession, the mental state are what are in the mix, and most of that plays out in the sentencing phase. So is he wrong in suggesting that that's what really needs to be discussed with the defendant when he stands before the court and says, yes, I intend to waive a jury?
I don't disagree that that's something that should be discussed with the client. What I'm saying is there's no requirement from this court or anywhere else that discussion be made part of the record or that the trial court inquire there. Surely you would hope competent counsel would explain all the rights that are being waived for each defendant. And in this case, the right to trial by jury is significant, obviously. But there's just no indication from the record that didn't take place. And obviously, I agree with Mr. Doughton. There's some capital cases where, in fact, many, where guilt's not an issue, and it's really a mitigation case. And this obviously is one of them.
Do you disagree with his suggestion that it's ineffective assistance of counsel to ever waive a jury in a death case?
Absolutely. I disagree. That was where I was going to go. That there is some certain situations where you may not want a jury to hear cases. I think that's not an illogical thought on the part of a trial counsel to think where the facts are so horrific and emotional that they would not want to present that to jury. They would want to present that to a three-judge panel of experienced jurists who hear horrible facts every day but can still set that aside and rationally decide whether or not death is appropriate in that case. So I don't think I think that's just taking it a step too far to say it's per se ineffective. That may be something that's a topic for the, as Mr. Dalton mentioned, for CLEs that that's recommended. But to say constitutionally ineffective, I think it's definitely taking that one step too far. There may be a situation based on who the panel may be, who the trial judge may be, and the facts of the case where an attorney, an experienced capital attorney, may not want the facts presented to the jury, and in their judgment may think it's better to go to a three-judge panel. So I think to say is that there's a per se ineffectiveness is taking it one step too far in this situation.
Counsel, I'm presuming that the attorneys that represented Mr. Faust were death penalty certified?
They were, and there's been no claim that they were not certified, so yes. So they were certified, they were experienced capital attorneys. And I don't think this court can say that there's that they were ineffective merely because they waived the rights of the jury. And clearly there's no indication in the record that they didn't explain all the rights that go along with it. And another point I think that needs to be made is one of their reasons for advising at maybe seminars or whatever not to waive jury is they give up all the appellate issues that go along with it, the jury selection issues, the jury instruction issues. I understand the practical reason for that advisement on the part of the defense bar, but I don't know if that needs to be part of this court's jurisprudence to say that defendants should not waive the right to jury because they're waiving the raising of potential errors. Obviously, those errors are brought up. They need to be addressed by the reviewing courts. But to waive that whole portion of a trial just so you don't get that potential arguments on appeal, I think is turns the law on its head. Like I said, I understand why they do it, but to say that by this court that they would have to, go to a jury just so they could preserve potential errors, I think is illogical and not something this court would want to say ever in a capital context. So there just no reason to go that far in this court's opinion, and also there's no evidence in this record that there wasn't anything but a valid understanding of the rights Mr. Faust was waiving. He was educated, he had his GED, and there's no evidence that he didn't understand.
That's really an issue for the legislature to consider, rather than this court.
Sure. All this court, any right can be waived. A jury trial, along with any other right, can be waived as long as it's valid and the voluntariness is clear on the record, and that's what we have here today. The court doesn't have any other questions. I'll turn next to Mr. Faust's argument regarding the indictment in this case. His argument is, under the specifications, the indictment itself as a whole is invalid because each of the felony murder A7 specifications mentioned just the name of the underlying crime that was committed, where the murder was committed in the course of aggravated robbery, aggravated burglary, aggravated arson, kidnapping, and rape. A number of things I want to say on that issue. First of all, this was a 20-some count indictment, and aside from the aggravated murder charges, each one of those underlying offenses was indicted separately. There's a separate count for aggravated robbery, a separate count for ag burglary, a separate count for arson, a separate count for kidnapping, and for rape. In each one of those sections, the elements of those underlying offenses were laid out, the code sections laid out. So there seems to be, first of all, there's no support in the law to say that merely not citing a code section is a facially defective indictment and would show a particularized need to go back in grand jury transcripts. But the fact that those elements were all separately indicted in that indictment puts defendant on notice and puts it properly on notice as to what he's being charged with. Specifically, this court's been faced with this issue before regarding the felony murder specifications. And specifically in Murphy and Joseph, this court held that these indictments, which mirrored the indictments in this case, were sufficient if they put the defendant on notice and informed him of what the underlying felony was for the felony murder specifications under A7. Moreover, in Joseph, this court cited to 2941.14c, where the court held and the statute indicate also, all that needs to be done under these capital specifications is just inform the defendant which one of the capital specifications he's being charged with. That's clear in this case. In this case, there's no objection to the indictment ever lodged in the trial court level, and that's significant for two reasons. First of all, the no objection puts it in a plain error standard of review. But secondly, the lack of objection, I would submit, evidences the fact that there was no surprise. Trial counsel knew exactly what Mr. Faust was being charged with, and the purpose of the indictment is to put them on notice so they can prepare a defense. There's no indication anywhere that they were in any way surprised by what Mr. Faust was charged with in this lengthy indictment. Admittedly, the indictment is long, but given the large number of felonies that occurred in that house that evening, it has to be that long. And it sufficiently put him on notice, and there's no indication otherwise. Appellant in his brief relied on Sparza versus Mitchell, a decision out of the Sixth Circuit, which found an indictment invalid because it didn't specifically indict that the offender was the principal offender. Subsequent to the filing of the brief, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the Sixth Circuit in Sparza and found that indictment, and I would add it's an A7 felony murder indictment just like we have here, the U.S. Supreme Court said that indictment and going to the jury on that was okay. In Sparza, there was no indication, he wasn't indicted specifically as the principal offender. It had the and/or language. And the court noted that Sparza was the only offender indicted in the case. There was no co-defendants or no indication that anyone else did that crime. It's exactly what we have here. Mr. Faust was the only one indicted with this crime. And I think the Supreme Court's per curiam reversal of the Sixth Circuit evidences a common sense approach to indictment claims. And I think common sense applies here when they need to be put on notice. They were on notice. There's no indication that they were surprised at all at the charges being levied against Mr. Faust in this case. Lastly, our appellant tries to bring the Ring, Blakely, Apprendi line of cases into this case. I would submit those are issues that are obviously going to need to be addressed by this court, but not in this case. Ring dealt with Arizona's capital statute, which is absolutely different than what we have here in Ohio. Ohio doesn't have the problem that Ring had in Arizona. In Arizona, the jury didn't make the death finding that we have in Ohio, so as this court's already held, Ring has no applicability here. But the point where they try to take Ring and the Apprendi cases is all those cases deal with the Sixth Amendment. The Sixth Amendment right to have jury findings that increase or elevate sentences. But there's been a push to take those line of cases and bring them over into the Fifth Amendment indictment claims. And I think that's what they're trying to do here by bringing Ring and Apprendi and have that bolster their claims that any claim regarding an indictment. I would submit my supplemental authority to the court that that push to get Ring and Apprendi and Blakely applying to Fifth Amendment indictment claims has been rejected. In footnote 4 of the Ring case, they specifically noted that Ring was only making a claim on a Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. And further in Apprendi, the U.S. Supreme Court noted that the 14th Amendment has never been construed to apply the federal right to indictment to the states. In their reply brief, they cite a number of federal cases, and there's a key distinction between cases that arise through the federal system where the courts there have looked to the right to an indictment, or have talked about a right to indictment, as opposed to state cases that where the Fourth Amendment hasn't been specifically held to apply that federal right to presentment to grand jury to those state cases. So, Ring, Blakely, Apprendi, and Jones. Obviously, those cases, there's many facets to those cases that are going to need to be addressed by this court, but this case isn't one of them, and it doesn't bolster or affect their indictment claim in this case. Simply put, there's no plain error. He was correctly indicted with these charges. The language of the indictment tracked the statute. It gave him notice of what each underlying crime was. And additionally, later in the indictment, the elements of those crimes were specifically listed in those individual counts. So there's no even suggestion that the grand jury did not specifically find probable cause to indict on these on each different theory of this case. Lastly, I'd just like to address the aggravating circumstances in this case. This court, as it does in every capital case, will conduct its independent weighing of the evidence and weigh the aggravating circumstances versus the mitigating factors. And the trial three-judge panel in this case gave a lengthy opinion indicating why they felt the aggravating circumstances outweighed the mitigating factors. I would submit that I would have liked the trial court opinion to be a little more clear on what the aggravating circumstances are, and I wanted to make clear to the court what the state's position is on what we feel the aggravating circumstances are. I would submit there's up to six aggravating circumstances in this case. There's the course of conduct, or sometimes called mass murder specification under A5. Then there's the five felony murder specifications. And at the very least, there's a distinction between the course of conduct and the felony murder specifications. This court held in Robb, those are two distinct concepts. And so those are two distinct aggravating circumstances between the felony murder specifications and the course of conduct. But I would also add that under each of those felony murder specifications, those are entitled to be considered as separate and distinct aggravating circumstances because, as this court held in State versus Robb and some other cases, there's a separate animus to each one of the actions done by Mr. Faust in this case. He broke into the house with the intent to commit a felony. He raped Damaris Coriano. Separately, he tied her to the bathtub, constituting the kidnapping. He killed Mr. Coriano. He stole items in the house. And then lastly, he set the fire so that there would be no witnesses to his horrible events. And each one of those actions by Mr. Faust is separate and distinct, and I would submit that they're entitled to be considered as separate aggravating circumstances when the court weighs the aggravating circumstances against the mitigating factors presented by Mr. Faust. And in that case, we feel that the scales definitely tip in favor of the trial court's decision to impose death on Mr. Faust. This was a horrible crime. There was absolutely no justification for it. They did present mitigation evidence. They presented their case, and it pales in comparison to what happened. And there's nothing about the nature and circumstances that in any way mitigates what Mr. Faust did. And the state would respectfully ask that this court uphold Mr. Faust's conviction and death sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Depker. Mr. Dowden, you saved a little less than 3 minutes of your time.
I'm sorry, but listen.
A little less than 3 minutes. Okay, 2 minutes and 45 seconds.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, I'd like you to respond to the prosecutor's explanation of the sufficiency of the indictment, given the fact that the crimes referenced in the indictment were separately charged. The underlying crimes for the capital specifications were separately charged. In other words, the kidnapping, the aggravated burglary, the aggravated arson, et cetera. How would that not be sufficient, given that point of reference within the indictment?
My answer to that is, in reviewing the sufficiency of the count, the counts must be considered independently. And there is case law cited in our brief where at least one federal circuit has found so. If this were a matter in which the indictment would have said aggravated burglary as specified in count 7, that may be a different question.
But is it realistic to presume that an aggravated burglary or kidnapping or rape mentioned in the indictment, enumerated in the indictment, is not the same aggravated crime that is referenced in the specifications?
My argument is, we're presuming a lot. You know that
if there were multiple defendants, you may have an argument here. But given the nature of this being a single defendant, one indictment pertinent to a single defendant,
then we're coming down to a harmless error argument. But again, our position is that in viewing the adequacy, I guess, rather than sufficiency of an indictment, it has to be done on a count-by-count basis. You can't look at the overall and then have this court make the connections of which acts go with which indictment. It's a very sloppy way to do it and creates...
So then it's form over substance is what you're arguing?
Oh, I guess the difference is the grand jury, the right to a grand jury isn't formed. I mean that's the stuff. And the basic argument...
The document produced, though, is form over substance.
But the document produced is out of this state has an independent, gives an independent right to it. And so that we have to decide how zealously we want to protect that right. But if there's at least one federal court who has found and indicated, and it's, again, it's cited in the brief, that it has to be done on an independent case-by-case basis, particularly when you're coming to a capital specification. The Supreme Court has over and over again talked about there has to be extra care in capital cases, that it gets a little more due process. They've said it, there's something different about these cases. And so we're sitting here today talking about, well, can't we presume this is correct? Can't we presume this is the right thing? And you know, as far as the waiver, in this case, Fitzpatrick talks about, I'm sorry for segueing into it, but I want to get this in quickly, talks about that in that case they did not address the sentencing issue at all, but they indicated that there was nothing, it was presumed it was correct because nothing indicated it was otherwise. And as a matter of fact, in Fitzpatrick, they were arguing, you know, he didn't know he had 12 jurors, and they said we'd already selected a jury, so clearly he knew even though it wasn't on the record. In this case, there is something to rebut the presumption. We have him giving notice to the court that he thinks the judge is the one who sentences him. So that presumption that's in Fitzpatrick doesn't apply. But in answer to your original question, we believe that the law is constitutionally that each count of the indictment must be reviewed independently, particularly in a capital case, and it's just not form, because the form is, again, the evidence that the grand jury did its job, and we believe that's more than just form.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dowden. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.